come back to order. I'd like to welcome all of you back, and we're going to be moving into the public employee retirement system testimony here in the approximately 2 hours that we have left today. First of all, we're going to call forward Sharon Walker from the Secretary of State's Audit Division, who is going to address the recently completed IT audit. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Sharon Walker with the Secretary of State Audits Division. I'm a deputy director with the Audits Division, and I oversaw the audit of the PERS, Information Technology Application Control Review. I'm not sure if you've all received copies of the audit report.
My committee administrator just stepped out for a moment. I know I have. Other members of the committee?
I don't know that.
Okay.
I just brought a couple of extra copies with me. I didn't bring very large ones. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what I'll do today is I have just a short list of some of the major findings to touch on. I'll give you a little bit of the background of what the audit was intended to evaluate and just briefly go through our recommendations. If at any point when I'm talking you find that I'm talking in terminology or language you don't understand, please feel free to interrupt me and ask me to clarify myself. In the summary of the report, which is on small Roman numeral 7 and 8, we described that we were taking a look, the purpose of this audit was to take a look at one specific component of the retirement information management system. And we knew at the time that the agency was developing or in the process of deciding what the their new system should be. We knew that they plan on developing a new system, and yet when we talked with them at the beginning of the audit, as we normally do, at that time the director was Fred McDonald, and he indicated that the system, that new system, could be 5 to 10 years off. And so based on that and the fact that in the meantime, the RIM system has to continue processing retirement and other transactions for the agency, we decided that it was beneficial to go ahead and take a look at how the system was working and evaluate that. So our main purpose as we started the audit was to take a look at the RIM system. On page 2, under scope and methodology, we described what our main objectives were: to determine if controls are in place for operating, for managing the system, determine if controls are in place to restrict access, basically security controls, and then determine if the controls are in place over processing, how the application processes data, and that would be input processing, the information that's output, and then how the data is stored. So we started the audit with three main objectives, and they're actually, the report focuses on, has four sections to it. The first one, the system development lifecycle methodology, are how they control system development and the day-to-day operation, day-to-day maintenance of the system. The second one, the second chapter of our report focuses on security issues. The third chapter is labeled application controls, and that's basically input processing, output, and storage of data. And then the fourth section of our report is other matters. While we were doing the audit focused on the objectives we originally intended to evaluate, some other things came to our attention, and so we also have a section of the report that describes some of those issues. So with that kind of a general description of what we were doing, we did the audit from July of 1999 through March of 2000. We gave the agency a draft report in mid-late April of 2000, and then talked with the agency and reviewed some other documents in May, April, May, to try to resolve some of the differences and how we each concluded on the situation. Then we issued the report in mid-June, so it has been a fairly recent report, realizing that in the meantime that PERS has done several things in terms of addressing the recommendations. What I'll do is just real briefly describe, during the period that we conducted the audit and at the time we issued the report, this is what our evaluation was of the issues. So the first major area, and the one that has caused the most concern, and rightfully so, is systems development lifecycle methodology. And to translate that into something that is not a matter of electronic bits and bytes flowing through cables or through connectors, systems development lifecycle methodology would be similar to, if you're operating a highway system, similar to the laws and rules that apply to driver's licenses, who gets licensed to drive on the road, similar to vehicle licensing laws, what kinds of vehicles are licensed, where do they drive, what kinds of speeds are allowed on the different roads. And it also relates to systems development in terms of everybody wants a road, you know, going straight from their house to their favorite shopping center in their office. But how do you prioritize? How do you decide which of these needs should be met? So in a different analogy, a different way of looking at it, information systems, SDLC, is similar to what are the rules of the road, how do we maintain and operate the system, how do we prioritize what needs to be fixed, how do we decide what gets done first or doesn't get done at all. So as we took a look at how does the agency manage RIMS, their existing, their current system, the one they rely on, we became aware of several issues related to testing standards when they decide to make a change. How do they test that change, make sure that it's working right before it actually goes into the program that's in operation? In the course of looking at testing, we became aware of an incident. And throughout the report, we cite a few examples, but that's just to show that usually during the course of an audit, we'll take a look, we'll evaluate what could go wrong. Well, in this case, we had examples of could go wrong, did go wrong. So the examples are not in any terms from a statistical sample where you can project how many times this happens or what dollar effect. They're just intended as examples of could go wrong, is going wrong in this case. So while we were looking at testing standards and requirements, one of the incidents that we cite in the report is a programmer was testing a change and over the course of 2 days accidentally sent check files to the DAS printer, print shop, and the checks were mailed out. So about 19 checks totaling just over $600,000 got mailed out to individuals. PERS didn't know it, didn't have documentation of it. How they became aware of it was when an individual contacted them and said, I don't think I was supposed to get these checks. They were able to recover, nine of the checks were cash. They were able to recover all but one of the checks. So there's one, the last time that we were at PERS, there was one of the checks totaling about $19,000 that's still out there somewhere. We're not sure who has it, but it's out there somewhere. So that is just one element of system development lifecycle methodology. You know, when you have a system, you're maintaining a system, you have to do testing, program change control in a controlled environment so that you don't accidentally send $600,000 to the printer and put them in the mail to somebody. Deferred maintenance. The system was brought online over a period of years from 1986 to 1991. And on the bottom of page 8, top of page 9, we briefly described that, you know, by 1996 or 5 years later, the agency had about 650 outstanding work requests. Well, work requests are basically somebody saying the system needs to be changed, isn't working the right way, or there's some new requirement that we need to get programmed in. So within 5 years after it was developed, there were 650 of these work requests, some of them dating back to 1989, some of them including core business functions. So to us, that was another symptom of system development lifecycle methodology not being in place. How do we prioritize? How do we make sure the most important things get done first and that important things do get done? By 1997, the agency decided we need to replace the system. It's not supporting our core business needs. We completely agree with that, and we did not start the audit with any kind of presumption that they didn't need a new system, and we still agree they need a new system. Besides deferred maintenance issues, we also took a look at audit trails. There are some of the transaction entries that they can make that change the balances directly and don't leave a trail of what change was made or who made it. Just a real basic control that has to be in place in a system, especially a system as core as our retirement system. You have to be able to track transactions and what changes they're causing. Another issue related to that was version control. It's the same as if all of us are working on a letter at the same time and Representative Witt goes in and takes the draft letter off the network and says, you know, I'm going to make these changes. And in the meantime, I come and get it, and I take the letter off the network and start making some changes. He copies his back in, I copy mine back in, and his changes are gone. And that's a simplified version. That's a simplified explanation of what version control is. When you have a program that's a core system, you need to make sure your programmers aren't overwriting each other's changes, and that version control was not in place. And then program documentation. Over the years, the system had had changes. Documentation wasn't adequate to tell what's happening in the system, what each of the parts of the system are doing. Program documentation was inadequate. So those are some of the main issues that we had related to how they operate, do the day-to-day maintenance of the RIM system. And based on our inquiries of them at the time and during the course of discussing the draft report, they were not able to provide us with documentation of their policies and procedures. And so we were concerned to the point that we recommended that they pause the new system development, get their system development lifecycle methodology in place so that then they can go about the new system development in a measured way rather than doing it with ad hoc without any rules. The second major area that we took a look at was security. And we found that both access to the programs in the database or the system itself, that access was not adequately controlled. There were numerous people, DAS consultants, former people who previously had been employees or consultants, who had access to the system. So the access to the data and programs wasn't being managed. The user access, or the people who are on a day-to-day basis going into the system and initiating transactions, doing calculations, the user access was also not controlled. People had access beyond what their job duties indicated they should need. And when you have an information system, because you have a lot of data, a lot of sensitive data that's easily accessible, you need to control who has access to that and least privilege or based on job needs is the standard that's usually applied in granting access to both the system itself, the data and programs, and to the ability to use the system. And those two issues were kind of symptomatic of the fact that they just didn't have good security policies and procedures in place. So that was the third area under security, related to security, that we address. Application controls. An application is a software program, whether it's the payroll program that you use to operate your business, whether it's QuickBooks, whether it's Excel. An application is just a program that you use to do something. So what we looked at was how does the agency in RIMS protect the input, processing, output, and storage of data to make sure that only valid authorized transactions are taking place? And the controls were not in place to make sure that was happening. And I, on page 18 and 19, particularly on page 19 of the report, yeah, there's a whole list of things that were not in place that should be to protect the integrity of the data being processed by that system. So I won't go into that, but as we were doing the audit, we became aware that PERS knew of duplicate payments totaling more than $412,000 that had occurred as a result of not having some of these processing controls in place or application controls in place. And we did some data analysis and found another couple of payments totaling about $86,000 that appeared to be duplicate payments, and we provided them that information so they could follow up on that. Error detection and correction. They have an out-of-balance list for that totaled over $30 million, and over the period of years that I've been involved in the financial statement audit that we do at PERS, that out-of-balance list has always been in the neighborhood of $30 million, and at one point it was up to $80 million. Some of those outstanding out-of-balance transactions date back to 1991. So these are not transactions that are just out of balance due to short timing differences. These are things that end up on this out of balance list. Think transaction, the debits and credits aren't matching, ends up there, and some of them just don't get resolved. So those were the main information system areas. As we took a look at RIMS, causes great concern for what was happening in new system development. Some of the other matters that came to our attention are on pages 23 to 25, and those are things like, as we took a look at some of the calculations, we happened to notice that lump sum money match wasn't calculated in the same way that other types of annuities are, that the annuity was being based on the date of distribution rather than the date of retirement. And because the lump sum includes interest up to the date of distribution, there was that period that would be paid for twice, in essence. And in the meantime, at a recent board meeting, and I don't remember which month it was, but the PERS board did discuss, and I, if I recall correctly, approved changing that. There was an incident we became aware of where a PERS manager purchased a used printer from a PERS employee. We did some comparisons to what market price would have been. They paid about $1,000 more for more than they would have for comparable or better new printer at the time. And we thought it was a little bit concerning that the person he bought the printer from was listed on his retirement information as his beneficiary. Accounts receivable management. We noticed PERS has over $1 million in accounts receivable. About 65% of that was over 90 days past due. About half of that, no payments have been made in over a year. The agency indicated that accounts receivable were not material to their financial statement, to their financial transactions. But actually, because most of their investments are handled by the Oregon Investment Council, based on the assets that they actually manage, that accounts receivable is significant. And we also made sure that they were aware of the new law relating to collection of delinquent debt.
What is going to be the general track that this takes now? Where does it go from here?
Well, where it goes from here is in the report. We've also incorporated the agency response, and we have some comments regarding those responses. Then we issue the report as a public document. We do plan to follow up on some of the more significant issues in this report. We do a financial statement audit for PERS every year, and so during the course of that, we'll be taking a look at some of these information systems issues, and that's also made an impact on the level of work that we have to do now that we understand the system issues better.
Okay, thank you. I would encourage all members of the committee to get familiar with this. It is interesting reading. PERS does have a response to almost everything here, as I recall, and it, as I say, is good reading. Mr. Voitko is going to respond, I think, to this here to a greater or lesser degree in just a while. So we'll get to that. Thank you. Let me just ask, anybody have any question for Sharon right now? You've got the report ahead of you. I would suggest you look at that and probably contact her again if you have any private questions about it. Okay. All right, Sharon, thank you. All right, at this time I'd like to call Jim Voitko, Executive Director of PERS, please. Just for the edification of the committee, I'd like to mention the order that we're going to go in. You've got an order of subjects listed on your agenda, but I think we're going to approach it a little bit differently today. We're going to begin with the flow chart here. And Jim, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Jim Voitko. And though I've only been the executive director for PERS for the last 7 months, this is my third appearance before you during that time, so this is getting to feel like home. We appreciate the chance to report to you today on four topics. I'll try to make my comments as brief as possible, but they are four important topics, so I hope that you would bear with me. And unfortunately, as I've said in previous testimony, it is one of our burdens that there's very little about PERS that isn't complicated, complex, and difficult for even us to understand. But there's very little I can do about that. And I think the first topic will indicate the degree of that complexity. The four areas we'd like to talk about today are the successful conclusion of the flowchart project that was requested by this committee, as well as a progress report on something we brought up in that same vein, which is our business rules repository effort, which we think is very critical, and we'll explain in a few minutes why that's so. The second topic is we'd like to give you a progress report on the 1999 PERS pension plan valuation, which is in progress, as well as the concurrent independent audit of the plan systems actuary, which the agency has put in place this year for the first time since 1992. The third thing we'd like to talk to you about is a brief report to this committee on the agency's effort to try to take the general sense of controversy that has quite clearly surrounded the PERS system and try to distill it into some specific identifiable problems that are current, unresolved, at least in the minds of stakeholders, that we can get our arms around, analyze, we can discuss them, and we can respond to them if there are means available to do so. And the last thing I'd like to talk about is our progress on our new technology platform, which I have some very good news to report to this committee, as well as some brief responses to the Secretary of State's audit that was conducted over the past year or so. Let me turn to the first topic, if you will, Mr. Chairman, and that is the flowchart and the business rules repository. As you all know, in May of this year, this committee asked that we produce a graphical picture of the flow of funds through the PERS system. And this was thought perhaps to aid both the committee, stakeholders, and ourselves in describing the way money flows through the system. We committed to complete this project by September, and I'm proud on the part of the staff to say we have done so. We brought, I believe it was in May, several examples of what this product might look like. And on my right, you see displayed what is in essence the master copy. There are 17 different flowcharts, each one that size, and each box on that master copy represents a flowchart in and of its own right. These pathways that we've documented for the committee represent, or I should say, about 99.5% of all dollars that enter and leave PERS flow along the pathways that we've documented here. I wonder if I might ask Dale Orr, our CFO, if he could take out one of the charts and maybe pin it up for you so you can get a sense of what one of those boxes might look like. Just pick any one you like, Dale. I must confess that there's some mind-numbing detail involved in these, but nonetheless, I think that they might prove important when there are disagreements or disputes about exactly what happens at the agency with regarding money flows. And we're going to provide this, obviously, not just to your committee, but the Joint Legislative Committee on Audits, once they heard of this project, has expressed an interest in it. Representatives of the League of Oregon Cities has also expressed an interest in it, and we will make sure that she has a copy as well. In earlier testimony to this committee, and as well as three other legislative committees, we mentioned to each of you that we are engaged in a massive multi-year project to document our rules and practices. This is something we're calling the Business Rules or the Rules Repository Project. This is very, very important. It really serves three important objectives that we're trying to serve. First, it's important that we document our rules to try to make what is a pretty opaque agency doing an opaque and difficult to understand task a little more transparent to stakeholders and oversight bodies, including the legislature. The second thing is that like all agencies, and probably in the country as well, but certainly in Oregon, we are facing the same wave of retirements that the agencies and public employers that we serve are facing as well. So this rules repository is in essence an insurance product or project for the agency. It's an insurance contract that allows us to capture some of this critical institutional knowledge so that it doesn't walk out the door with some of our older staffers who have earned their retirement and retire in greater numbers over the next 5 to 15 years. The third thing is that it is quite clear to us, and has been for some time, that in order to build a new computer system and system generally, and we're talking about something more than just a computer system, we're talking about the way the agency processes its business, we need to document these rules so that, in fact, they can be programmed and passed on to the people who implement these processes. Just to give you a sense of the magnitude of this, so far we have in the repository over 200 business rules, and we've been working at it now for about 4 months, or about 5 months, I think. We started the project about the last time we approached this committee. And we have over 300 glossary terms. At any given point in time, there are between 60 and 100 business rules in progress. Because our charge is so complex, we actually have several different pension plans, all of which are operative for every single member of the PERS system. We choose the one that is most beneficial to them. That's a statutory direction from the legislature itself. Plus, one of them is one of the most highly complex hybrid pension plans that exists in the country, at least so our colleagues around the country tell us, as well as consultants. Plus, we have separate programs for police and fire and judges and other programs as well. The bottom line is that there is a virtual certainty that this rules repository will reach 1,000 rules or more. And some of us are beginning to scratch our heads and say that, you know, there's a chance we might reach 2,000 before we're done. I hope that's not true, but if it is, it merely tells me that the task is even more worthwhile. I present to you the charts. We can offer actually to print out copies for every single member. In the appendix that you have in your testimony, there are slimmed down versions of these charts that you can look at under tab A. If you want larger versions of these, we'd be happy to provide them. We'd need a very big room, though. I'd like to turn to my second topic, if I would, Mr. Chairman, or would you like me to entertain questions as we go through the topics?
I think what I'd like to do is, in a measured fashion, go ahead and handle some questions, entertain some of those while we go along here. I don't want to get too far behind, and I'd like the committee to be sensitive to that, but while a couple of these things are fresh, I'd like to ask you. One of the complaints about the PERS system up to this point in our hearings has been lack of consistency and a fear that perhaps the agency did not have its rules of operation documented. And I really applaud the effort. This is Herculean, I can tell that. When it comes to dissemination of these rules, dissemination of the flowchart, how do you plan to handle that within the agency to where there is going to be consistency and continuity from individual to individual?
Well, first of all, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the rules are being written by the domain, what we call the domain experts inside PERS themselves, number one. Number two is they'll work their way into all the training manuals as we hire new employees, as our employees retire or leave the agency. The third is that we have an intranet set up in which this repository, as it begins to build, actually resides on that and is accessible to any employee who's authorized to enter our network. The fourth is that unless our lawyers tell us otherwise, I see no reason why this can't be placed on the agency's internet, which will be accessible to anybody. Now, as you can see from tab B, some of these rules are not easy to understand when they are written down in a format that is excruciatingly accurate. And I think we put 10 rules in just to give you a flavor for what the breakdown of these rules is like when you get down to this level of specificity. But I think that the big difficulty will not be how we communicate it or whether we can communicate it. The big issue will be how understandable the rules are, given the need for such detailed, mind-numbing accuracy in order to get them right.
Are these beyond dispute in the agency? Do you have individuals who are in charge of the same area who dispute the fact that there is a finite answer to this particular flow or this situation?
A very interesting question, Mr. Chairman. In fact, these are generated by the domain experts, but they must pass muster by the senior representative from every single part of the agency. It's what we call the Business Rules Committee, mm-hmm. and they are literally brought up. They are edited and argued over to the point of, again, mind-numbing specificity. And in fact, they actually vote, just like the gladiators of old. Yes, my section of PERS can live with this rule as it's specified. It's consistent with the rules that we're writing, or no. And I will tell you that I've attended personally at least 7 of these meetings, and something on the order of anywhere from 20 to 50% of the rules are sent back to the domain expert to be rewritten until they meet that committee's test of accuracy across applications within the PERS system.
How do you contrast life at PERS under this plan, this flow chart, these business rules compared to life before these came into existence?
Well, I think there's many, many changes that are taking place at PERS. And I think the two things that this particular project, particularly the business rules, is wreaking is twofold. One is that everybody who's involved in this process already has a day job processing the normal course of business, and that's what we are set up to do resource-wise. So this is all extra work on their point of view. So in one sense, they're not happy about this project, and I think that's reasonable to say, and they wouldn't object to hearing their executive director say that. On the other hand, I think that it wasn't long after we launched this project that everybody's head started going up and down, that it was long overdue, and that this is a good thing.
Okay. How this may get into another area that we want to explore further later, but how important is it that the actuary for PERS understand this chart to perform an accurate evaluation?
There are key parts of it that are very important, and I'm going to treat that issue later on in the testimony because I think it's important to understand that most of the things that we do at PERS can have significant effects on an individual here or a community there if we do them incorrectly or whatever. But the vast majority of these issues do not touch on what we have perceived thus far as the core root causes of concern for the PERS system. Having better data or a smoother working computer system or any of those things, those are not the reasons why employers will sometimes stand up and say PERS rates are just too high, the PERS system is too expensive. It's not, this is a flea on the camel's back, if you will, in terms of affecting the overall structure and financial dynamics of the system. In fact, later on in my testimony, one of the things I'd like to bring out is a process that we would like to launch, hopefully with your blessing, to try to distill those things which really make a big difference to the system and its financial dynamics, particularly as it affects employer rates, the overall cost of the system, but as well as equity among large blocks of members, because the PERS Coalition has points of view on that. But I think it's important to distinguish between those things that drive the system and hundreds of millions and if not billions of dollars within Oregon, and those things which make our life more difficult because it's more difficult to administer with an older computer system or with poor data or whatever. Those are bigger problems for our staff than they are for the system as a whole. There are big things out there that can move hundreds of millions of dollars around. These generally are not those.
We'll be interested to hear about those. I will be anxious because I realize that there is a great difference of opinion as to what our problems really are here. So looking forward to hearing that. Okay, any other questions here before we move on to your next point?
Well, we'll move right into that, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, on the second topic, which is where we stand on the current plan valuation and the actuarial audit. To introduce that topic, I might note that the plan valuation is a critical moment for the PERS system. It occurs every 2 years. It's required to do so by statute. It is the, in essence, financial report card for the system. How well is it funded? And it does two things. One is it's how well is it funded. Two is what is our best new guess? We re-estimate what the liabilities of the system are to employees, both now as well as into the future, both current retirees and people that will retire in the future. And the third thing is whether or not what rates would be necessary for the individual employer entities that they would have to pay to make sure that those liabilities are matched with assets. So this is a critical time for the plan. Because we know that there's controversy, and because it's good practice, and because we have some issues ourselves with respect to some of the big questions that drive big dollars in the system, the agency decided to do an audit of this actuarial valuation concurrently with the actuary, partly so that we could respond to these things in midstream as opposed to wait until they're baked into this valuation. And in fact, that process is going right along. You may recall that back in 1999, the PERS board selected Milliman and Robertson as their actuary, I think, for the next 2 years. Is that correct? It's a two-year contract. And thus far, M&R has gotten the necessary information from PERS. And in fact, they have gone through and reviewed all of the current assumptions that lie behind the analysis, many of which do have substantial or potentially substantial effects on the financial dynamics of the system, and presented those to the PERS board over the last two monthly meetings. Appendix C of this testimony is a highly abridged summary of those recommendations and a little bit of comment from the staff as to what their direction might be on overall employer rates, for example. And I want to emphasize that this is an overall indication because, as you know, while statistical projections we use for actuarial valuation are generally pretty accurate for large groups, so long as we have almost 500 local employers that are unpooled, and therefore the majority of them are quite small, some of them with as few as 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 employees, their PERS rates, no matter what, will be inherently volatile, no matter how good the assumptions are for public workers in Oregon overall. And so this is a key reason why for the last 4 or 5 months, our deputy director, Mr. Bailey, has been out literally visiting every corner of the state and has met with, I think, 230 individual local employers to explain this issue and to discuss with them our pooling initiative and its effects. Let me say a few words about what kinds of things we might expect to come out of this valuation. We expect the final numbers to be in probably in November. It's risky to say what you think might come out of the valuation because there are so many different factors that drive the final numbers. But I will make three things that we expect, and we'd be surprised if they didn't happen. They could. First, we expect the roughly 70 local employers that have substantial unfunded liabilities and, in particular, fewer assets than their employees, which under our money match system is a very difficult financial position to be in. They will probably continue to be in this financial situation, with the exception of a handful that have done lump sum payments to the system. And, in fact, this problem that they face might be worse. But remember, that's 70 of the roughly 500. So it's a very targeted population, but that's not to say that they're not experiencing financial distress. Second, we would expect that rates for unpooled local employers, particularly small ones, will remain just as volatile as they have been in the past. We know of nothing other than total coincidence, which is unlikely, or pooling that will remove the inherent volatility for small employers. And the third is that we believe that it's likely that absent a major change in the underlying actuarial assumptions, that the large pools, the teachers and state workers, are not likely to see major changes in their rates. But again, that's assuming that we don't make significant changes in actuarial assumptions, which leads into an important second topic, and that is the actuarial audit. Whether there are compelling reasons to make such changes that would have big financial consequences for fund plan funding, the plan report card, as well as employer rates, i.e. the cost of the system, will depend in part on what we find out ultimately from the actuarial audit. As I say, for the first time since 1992, we are conducting an audit. I don't know that we've ever conducted one that is actually concurrent with evaluation. We've hired Mercer and Company. I must say I'm very pleased with their work so far. They are asked to do, as noted on page 5 of your testimony, a variety of things in their work product. They characterize this as a full-fledged audit in their testimony before the PERS board. So we did not leave anything out that they felt was vital to look at. I think that's important to note. They have already made an initial report to the agency as well as to the PERS board at a meeting day before yesterday. And so far, the things that they have found so far that they have put down in writing and delivered to us and to the board are that the current plan's actuaries' qualifications and adherence to actuarial standards is appropriate. They found no reason why M&R was not qualified to be a plan actuary for the state of Oregon. There were a variety of methodological areas where Mercer and Company has suggested either technical changes to the valuation methodology or the need for additional study. They have characterized those as minor and not likely to result in any material change to the plan valuation overall. However, there are three areas that Mercer suggests that the staff and the board study further that would lead to, that could, if they were adopted, lead to more substantial change in the plan's financial status and employer rates. And this is probably the most important part of the audit thus far, and maybe the most important part in its entirety. They have three issues, and I really, if you like, I can go into each one of them, but they're very complex. Suffice to say that each of these three issues can have significant effects on whether the plan is well-funded or not so well-funded. It can have effects on its future funding status. It can also have significant and near-term effects on employer rates. In all three cases, I might add, Mercer suggested lines of inquiry for us, if confirmed by close analysis and adopted, would tend to make the plan's valuation more conservative and tend to raise the overall level of employer rates above what they are now. And I realize that this is a possibility that is probably not welcomed by employers, but that's why you do audits, to find out where you really stand. Where do we go from here? Over the next 30 days, PERS is going to engage both actuarial firms in joint discussions of these issues, because we've already discovered that there are logical reasons on both sides. And by the way, Mercer has also testified that nothing that the PERS plan has done thus far or the actuary has recommended is out of bounds in terms of generally accepted accounting practices. The question is, from their point of view as a second advisor, are they advising a more conservative route and therefore one that would tend to raise employer rates versus what M&R has advised in the past? So it's really not you did it wrong and you did it illegally or contrary to professional practice. It's that our advice to you as professionals is we're recommending a more conservative approach. So we're going to get the actuaries together and see how many areas they can finally agree on. And where they can't, the board has to move ahead and complete the valuation and set rates. So the board must adopt some actuarial standard and will do so. I think it's important to note that the reason that these are most important, and particularly the assumption of the assumed rate of growth in plan liabilities, that is benefit levels for public employees going out in the future, is so important. If I could paraphrase very closely what the actuarial auditor said, is that the expense of a pension system is driven largely by the level of benefits it provides. And this is especially true of Oregon because that's the way the money match works. Money match actually doesn't give employers the kind of relief from investment gains that traditional defined benefit plans give. So we have a peculiar system, and the issue is are we correctly estimating what the future stream of liabilities is so that we can correctly charge employers for the obligations to their employees. So that's the update on the actuarial evaluation. We'll have significantly more to tell you within less than 60 days, knock on wood, because right now this is occupying a substantial effort on the part of PERS, as well as its actuaries, as well as the board. That's my second topic. I could stop there and entertain questions, Mr. Chairman, if that's your pleasure, or I could move on to topic three.
Let's hold up just for a moment. Under the money match system, how can we know with any certainty, given all the actuarial ebb and flow, what our future liabilities will be?
The glib answer, Mr. Chairman, is that you never know. Because these are all estimates of what might happen in the future, how many people get disabled, and so on. The thing that makes the money match system even more difficult to estimate is that you're not only estimating the traditional defined benefit actuarial uncertainties, how many people get hurt, how long do they work, how much turnover there is, at what ages they tend to retire, how many years they've served. You also have the issue of having to predict the capital markets and predict the flow of some of those investment returns back into the benefit stream, which tends to drive it higher. If I were to have brought a chart of benefits to public employees, you would see that the bull market of the 90s has had a very substantial effect on the retirement benefits, either current or projected, for employees who happen to have worked during that period. And so you can see the connection. From the point of view of employees, this is a terrific thing. From the point of view of employers, this may be a terrific thing if they're pleased that if it's helped them recruit employees and retain employees. It may not be such a wonderful thing when the costs of that kind of system come to pass, have to be paid. So the answer is you never know, but Oregon's system has additional things that one must predict in order to in order to get a handle on what the most likely stream of benefits are now obliged and are obliged to employees.
So as far as Money Match goes, instability is inherent and will always be there.
Well, let me be careful about how I answer that question, because I don't want to, I want to make clear what I mean by instability. If it means that by instability, if you mean it is more difficult to predict the future financial dynamics, I would agree that that's the case. If you mean that it is inherently unstable, we'd have to define that in some way.
I meant more from the, I hate to say it this way, the rate guessing game.
I would say that if you put yourself, and recall that I'm charged to protect the trust fund, not to look out for employers' interests or organized labor's interests, so let me hypothesize a little bit. If I were to put myself in the position of an employer, I might characterize my situation as I have an expected stream of obligations to the employees who work for my entity, and they are not fixed. In fact, we'll talk about that in a minute. But they're not fixed in the sense that I can estimate how many years they might work for me and then know what I would have to pay. There's also that added complication of how the money match rules work, the money match statutory rules, I might add, and as well as agency implementing rules that, in essence, feed back some of the investment gains back into the liability stream. And that's influenced in the short run, certainly, and in the long run, maybe, by the PERS board's crediting decisions in any given year. And it's a very complicated topic. In fact, I will tell you, I don't think that it has been sufficiently well analyzed. In the middle of this audit, we actually requested Mercer to take on or bid for, if you will, at cost estimate, an extended task, and that is to look at precisely the question that you're asking me about. We're also building a model within the PERS system that's going to look at precisely those issues. So this is something that's the question you raised, the degree of uncertainty, is something that's also of concern to us, and we have two different tacks that we're taking to try to pin it down and therefore explain it to our stakeholders as well as our board, which is our chief responsibility.
Okay, thank you. Proceed.
If I could turn to topic number three, which is the question of the PERS problem and responses, and I have to tell you that as a new director, one of the most amusing and frustrating conversations I had was a conversation out in the hall where somebody quite genuinely asked me, what do you think about the PERS problem? And I said, well, what problem do you have in mind? And they said, well, you know the PERS problem. And I said, well, give me a hint about which direction it might go. The reason I mention that story is that it's very frustrating if you feel that you must respond and you should respond. It's part of your charter to stakeholders. It's very frustrating not to know precisely what they have in mind when they say there's a problem. Our agency and our board, and I think I can speak for them here, are deeply concerned about the level of controversy surrounding the PERS system. I mean, when you think about it, we're currently being sued by a group of employers whose case appears to argue in part that PERS should have been run and should be run going forward in a manner that would fundamentally alter benefit streams. I don't think that there's too much case about that. Interestingly enough, at the same time, we are simultaneously being sued by the PERS Coalition, a consortium of public employee unions whose proposals, and some of those are proposals before the board itself, would demand equally sweeping changes in the PERS system and similarly fundamental but likely polar opposite effects on member benefits. In many respects, PERS finds itself in the middle between these two constituencies. They're not always apart, but on some key issues, particularly those that drive large amounts of money in the system, they are often in different camps. And at the same time, it's not a surprise that the PERS board is finding that the number of individual member appeals, which in the past have been very rare, are rising extremely rapidly. In fact, probably a majority of the last board meeting was taken up simply by addressing individual member decisions. And when you think that we have almost 300,000 members, we could field quite a hearing panel in order to accomplish that if that were to continue to go up. I've been trying to figure out exactly how to phrase this, but because I think about this controversy because it's partly my job to try to get my arms around it. And if I might offer some unsolicited advice to anybody including members of the legislature, who wants to understand the controversy, the swirl of controversy around PERS, I'd recommend you consider four factors. First is, there's a lot to argue about. There's a great deal of money in the PERS system, $40 billion and rising, including more than $4.5 billion, which under the money match statutory provisions and implementing rules are placed in a gain-loss reserve and have not been specifically distributed by the PERS board to any particular stakeholder. But nonetheless, they've been actuarially pledged to the system's ongoing stream of obligations to members. So there's a lot to argue about. I mean, the more money you throw down on the table, the more people you'll find that want to get involved and discuss about it. And by the way, the people who are involved with us in discussing it all have legitimate reasons to be at the table. The second thing is that the second reason for this controversy in our judgment is that in the money match tier one system, our state has a pension system whose basic statutory structure makes benefits to individual members and therefore costs to employers indeterminate. And this gets back to the question that you asked me, Mr. Chairman. That means that the pension benefit that a member will receive is not set by a fixed, controllable, algebraic, if you will, and highly understandable set of rules or algorithms. But instead, that benefit is determined largely by the behavior of the stock and bond markets, the underlying and unambiguous, because this is pretty straightforward, return guarantee that is laid down in the PERS statutes, and three, the earnings crediting policies adopted by the PERS board in implementing the money management system. So while the benefits are not fixed, I think most people would perceive that the obligation of employers to pay them is assumed to be pretty much set in concrete. So in answer, this is a better way of answering your question before, how this system might look from the seat of some employers. The third reason for the general level of controversy is that while the money match system was created in 1946, it was really put away in a dusty drawer, if you will, for quite a long time. It was really rendered relatively dormant for the last several decades because the legislature created other methodologies that we were required to apply and choose the best one for members. And so the money match simply didn't match up, if you will. So not much time was spent on it because not many people retired under it. That began to change. And with the bull market of the last 5 years, it suddenly became the way we do business. Because under statute, we must choose the best calculation. Money match is now, for the vast majority of members, as we calculate it, the best calculation. So now we have to wheel this program back out. And I think I've discussed this before. It's like bringing an old car out of a garage and trying to figure out how it works. But what that means is a lot of things are potentially unsettled. And if our stakeholders feel that way, I think the staff would agree with them. The fourth reason for the controversy is we have a system in which key stakeholders, as I've mentioned before, appear in many instances to have substantially different views on how the PERS board and the agency should execute its statutory responsibilities. So we have a lot of money. We have a system that's indeterminate, that has more uncertainty than the average system. We have a sudden switch to a calculation system that was set back in 1940, but relatively little used since then. And then we have stakeholders that have big stakes in this and don't always agree on what PERS should be doing. That combination of factors is a surefire recipe for controversy if I ever saw one. So what do we do about it? Well, unless we're given reason to think otherwise by the legislature, our agency must take the statutory structure of the money match system as a given. Regardless of whether any aspect of it chooses to or has a reason to accentuate the controversy or not. It is the law, and that's what we're supposed to do. But there are some things that we can do. For example, the agency does not have to leave the money match program as unexamined as it has been over the last several decades, and we're not. In fact, we have begun a comprehensive analysis of the money match program, beginning last April with a foundation analysis of the gain-loss reserve and the deficit account provisions of the PERS statute as they affect the financial dynamics of the system. And that was just a down payment on that issue. And I believe we sent a copy to you, Mr. Chairman, in case that was something of interest to you. We'd be happy to supply it to all members of the committee if they're interested. We also have done two additional money match analyses because they were related to some decisions that had to be made regarding lump sum payments that major employers made to our system. So we've continued on in that vein. The third thing is that we have begun construction of a financial model to try to get a handle on what the true financial dynamics of the money match system are under a wide variety of future circumstances. We don't know what the future will hold, but part of, I think, your question, Mr. Chairman, is under all kinds of scenarios, does the system produce results that are recognizable and understandable? And we're going to try to resolve that, and we are already reasonably far along in building that model, which I think our stakeholders will take a special interest in. The fourth thing that we're doing is that we're continuing our review of the relatively smaller, they may only move a few million dollars here or there, which in a $40 billion system doesn't sound like much, but it adds up. But we're continuing our review of internal money match calculations and practices and have completed or proposed changes in numerous areas. And I can tell you that those reviews are going to continue and more changes are likely to follow, perhaps big ones. I don't know. I don't want to get ahead of our own effort. But the point is that we will go through every money match rule and model the money match system as best as we can, and we won't stop until we've exhausted our capabilities. The second thing we can do about this controversy is that we no longer have to continue the current policy of not offering a recommendation to the PERS board regarding earnings distribution. This is the one area where statutory latitude that has been granted to the board does potentially result in the board's crediting decision influencing benefit levels among members, at least in the very short run, and may have some long-run effect on benefit levels and therefore employer rates. I have already asked our board or informed our board of our desire to seek an opportunity to be more, to present an agency recommendation on this question. It has not been the recent practice of the agency to do that, but we're going to ask our board for the opportunity to do so. They, of course, don't have to listen to us. This is the statute lodges this responsibility and this authority in the board, not in the agency. But I think my assessment of the agency's responsibility is to offer such advice. We're also going to recommend, and by the way, our actuarial auditors concur in this, that we move to an annual versus a biannual PERS plan valuation. We have suffered from the fact that by evaluating the plan every 2 years, we spend an entire year in the cycle using dated information. Our stakeholders have dated information. We have dated information because this stuff cannot be done on a one-off basis. It has to be done in the context of looking at the whole system plan together and doing all the calculations at the same time with the same data. It will cost the system a little bit more, but we're talking on the order of a buck or two per member to get information that's more reliable and more timely, and quite frankly, I think it's money well spent. What else are we doing to address this controversy? Well, I think that PERS no longer has to remain passive about this problem that we have in trying to get more specific definitions of the problems people have with the PERS system. We cannot address general unhappiness, general concern, or general mistrust very easy because we don't know what it means. And we know that it's very important. Somewhere out there may lurk current core policy problems that haven't been resolved, that maybe haven't been well defined, and we're not going to sit back and wait for somebody to stumble on them and present them to us. We're going to go out and actually press our stakeholders on these issues, and in fact, in our testimony, which I won't go through all of these, we have what we did was we listed all of the problem statements that we have heard or received in letters from local employers, heard in ad hoc committee meetings, heard in meetings with other stakeholders or in testimony before the board, and we've put them all together and we'll add more, but I think our stakeholders can expect a visit from us to go through this list of potential problem statements and say, is this the problem? Is this the PERS problem? And particularly, is this a core policy problem that has major financial effects on the system? If it's something that affects that would improve better administration, we're interested because those are important. But what we're really looking for are the things that move hundreds of millions of dollars, because that, if we make an error on those issues, if we're doing something wrong there, we want to know about it, and we want to know about it soon. There are some constituencies that haven't been shy about this. The PERS Coalition, for example, has presented relatively focused criticisms of very specific current core PERS policies. They presented draft alternatives that they would like us to consider and the board to consider. They've even gone so far as to suggest exactly how they want their proposals analyzed, and has done so in writing. So some of our constituencies have been excruciatingly precise about what they believe the problem is, and and how it should be fixed and how we should even analyze the proposed fix. What we're trying to get to here is a process by which we hope we get an invitation. We're asking for an invitation to appear before this committee or some other that the legislature might designate later on this year to do several things. One is we'd like to give an update again on our continuing analysis and review of the money match rules, because we will surely have more to talk about then, because we're not going to stop. The second thing is that we'd like to report to you on our effort to gain some consensus among our stakeholders about what the big PERS problems are as opposed to the little nagging problems. And there's always a difference, and it's a mistake to mix the two. The third thing that we can do at that time is we should have definitive data coming out of the valuation in which we can tell you the actuarial assumptions that the board has accepted, what we recommended, what they chose to put into the valuation, and what the financial consequences are on plan funding as well as employer rates. So there will be a lot to talk about if the legislature would be willing to entertain a return visit by us. I guess it's not often that an agency director asks to come back, but there it is. I think it would be good for the system and probably be good for us too. That's the completion of my third topic, Mr. Chairman. I have one more remaining. I will proceed at your pleasure.
I'd just like to say that I appreciate your offer to appear before us again. This is the last funded interim committee meeting that we have, but I plan to ask for another one as a result of this offer. I've found myself thinking about this at times I shouldn't have been thinking about this. And I don't want to quit now, and so I'll do my best to prevail on leadership to fund another meeting, because I am especially interested in those topics, especially from your standpoint, separating the issues from the non-issues from your perspective. If you could share that with me in some detail before that next meeting, if we're so lucky to get that, I would appreciate that, because I'd like to cover some ground with that before that next formal meeting.
Without a doubt, Mr. Chairman, we'd be happy to. And in fact, if you were to go to that effort, we would feel a special obligation to make that time and money worthwhile to the legislature.
Okay. I'll see what I can do. Thank you. Go ahead.
The fourth and last topic, which is the progress on our...
Excuse me just for a moment.
I'm sorry.
Representative Hansen.
Well, if for various reasons it becomes impossible to have another formal meeting, I would certainly be willing to participate in an informal discussion on these issues.
Sure.
If that would work.
You bet. Noted and appreciated. Thank you. Thank you.
I might add, Mr. Chairman, if I could extend the agency even further, if it became difficult to have a meeting and we went to an informal meeting, regardless of that, we're willing, if the committee should so desire to direct us, to answer the legislature at your direction in writing on whatever issues you should glean from this testimony and choose to direct us to respond to in writing.
Thank you.
The fourth and last topic, and I do appreciate your patience very much, the OPIS progress report and the IT audit issues. I've got some excellent news to present to you on the progress that we're making in the design and risk reduction efforts for the new OPIS project. We've been at it now for about 18 months, and there's been relatively little tangible product that we could show to people. That's changing quite rapidly as we near the end of this progress. Let me just give you three particular items that I don't want to get real technical, because I would begin to bore myself. But we've had some major milestones here. The first is that we have successfully moved a large pieces of the PERS database from the old RIMS database system into our new proposed relational database. This is a major step forward. And it's also very important to reduce the risk of this project, because we have proved that we can take the data from the old, relatively decrepit and highly inflexible database and move it into the new one and have it work. In fact, while it was in there being tested, we actually exercised some of the data and used it in a live presentation to the board on a live policy issue, and it worked. And it took about one-tenth of the time to extract that data than it did from the old RIM system. The second thing is that we have successfully tested what's called the EDMS, or Electronic Document Management System. You may have heard the Secretary of State refer to auditable trails. Well, right now, a lot of the work that we have to do is is in manila folders, and it is very difficult to create the kind of auditable trails that anybody would like when you're operating in what is, in essence, a 19th century mode. We are extremely excited about the tests that we have done on this new electronic document management system, because it automatically tells you who the document went to, when it got there, what was done to it, when it left, and where it was sent to, and that's all recorded for posterity. And it is an extremely exciting technology. The third thing is that we have successfully tested our system architecture, which is the guts. I mean, it is the rules by which the system operates. And we have built that system architecture, and we've tested it in two different ways. We task-tested it by building some sample applications, and we threw it at the architecture, not unlike building the frame of a house and then seeing if you can attach a window or a door to it. And if you can, then it makes sense, or if you can put a roof on it. It passed every one of those tests. And then we platform tested it. We actually copied it onto a CD-ROM. We put it in the back seat of a car, and we drove it to Beaverton. Went into a place that had a computer system that was entirely different than ours, put it on the system. And remember, we're talking about 30,000 lines of complex computer code, and it ran just like that. So far, knock on wood, things are progressing quite nicely, but it's not because it's just happening by accident. There's a lot of very talented people working hard at it, and we've been getting some help from people here in Salem, including the legislature, by being willing to approve our funding. We're also doing several other key tests, which we think will be resolved perhaps by the next time we see this committee, and that is our ability to build some test sample applications using not contractor staff, but our own staff, which is a big test for state agencies to see if we can do it, not just hire other people to do it from the outside, from the private sector. We also are completing a summary of target system requirements, which is a must. It's part of what's called SDLC. Before you begin to build the system. And most importantly, we are building what we believe is a state-of-the-art project management program or structure that controls the development of the software. This is, in essence, what SDLC is. It's the way you organize the portfolio of software in the agency. And I think we've attached the presentation that we gave to the JLC IMT about a week or so ago, and it goes into some depth on this question. So if you're interested in the progress that we've made on Opus, perhaps in more technical detail, we have done that write-up and done it to and presented it to the JLC IMT, and I think it really is right now the kind of the state-of-the-art representation of where we are in Opus. Let me turn lastly to the issues raised by the IT audit of our old legacy system, RIMS. I would just say that the audit found a variety of deficiencies in the old RIMS system, including the software management program that's been in place there since it was put in place back in the late 1980s. We've addressed these issues twice before the JLC IMT, once again before the JL, the Joint Legislative Audit Committee. We have a comprehensive action plan which really takes the corrective actions and makes sure that every one of the issues has a corrective action. We divide them into two pots, however. The first one are directed to actions that we're taking within the RIMS system itself. We don't want to do too much within RIMS. We're trying to get RIMS out the back door. It's kind of like having a very old car that's definitely not going to qualify as an antique that's heading for the junkyard. You don't want to put too much money in it. But at the same time, you have to keep it functional because our membership depends on it to get their checks out. And so within that system, we are doing things like we've hired a software director who was the most skilled instructor of software management and SDLC process in the state of Oregon. We're very pleased to have him on board. We also are spending the trust fund's money to buy from DAS a mirror image of what's called an isolated testing region of our system on their computer. It's expensive. But what it is it's a duplicate system, if you will, that exists side by side where we can make run tests and not have to worry about affecting what's called the production environment. In the past, it's been perceived, and the cost estimates that we've got were just considered prohibitive, but But DAS has been very willing to work with us on this, and we think that, we're already successfully testing that isolated testing region. And there's a variety of things that we're doing in the current environment, all of which are underway. In fact, most of which are complete. I shouldn't say most of which, at least half of which are completed already. Then there's another group of things where the right solution is to engineer it into OPUS, because it's prohibitively costly to go back and change RIMS. Let me give you an example. I think that Ms. Walker talked about the lack of information about transactional history in a particular account. One of RIM's basic structural deficiencies is it does not automatically log a transaction history. That is not something that you can fix with a little computer patch. It's the way the system was built and designed. And so there are a variety of things. Also, the auditable tracking of documents, where by far the most cost-effective thing to do is to take those fixes and actually build them in correctly into the new system from the get-go. And so we have divided those into two pots, but we have something going or completed on every single one of those issues. We're pretty pragmatic. I think I can almost guarantee that there will be some duplicate checks that go out every year and some extra checks. It's when you are sending out 1 million benefit checks a year. I mean, imagine if you had every one of those checks in an envelope and you stacked them up, it would be a pile 12 times the size of the Capitol building we're in today. I guarantee you that as good as we are, we're going to screw up a few checks. The fact of the matter is that you have to presume that you're going to try for excellence in all respects. But you have to be sensible about where you spend your money. And in our judgment, the right place to spend money in major terms is in the new system, which is going to have a 15-year life, rather than the old system, some parts of which will only have a 2-year life. That PERS response report, as well as our responses to the audit division, are included in this testimony, or the responses to the audit division are in the back of the audit report. You can read them and get a sense. And I think the audit in general, particularly the issues that they raised with respect to the RIM system, we agree with them hands down. The only issue is, what's the smartest thing to do about them? So we think it's been a constructive process. In fact, we have invited the audits division to come back attend an SDLC-oriented planning meeting for OPUS. Actually, it's a display meeting of work underway on September 20th, and they've accepted our invitation. So they also have another audit going at PERS, and we've had a successful kickoff to that. So I think things are working pretty smoothly on that front. We have a lot of work to do because OPUS itself is a big project. Keeping RIMS alive and functioning is a big project. And then, of course, we have these controversies that we talked about earlier. So we don't have a lot of idle hands. With that, Mr. Chairman, I want to thank you and the committee again for your patience in listening to our issues. If there's anything that we can do to help the legislature or this committee move along in terms of understanding and do whatever they in their wisdom choose to do about the PERS system, we'd be more than happy to help.
Thank you. You've been most helpful and forthcoming, and we appreciate that. Certainly you've attacked a multifaceted demon here with much zeal, and I appreciate that. I wanted to ask just a couple of things. I don't want to digress too far, but we are anxiously awaiting the valuation, and wish Mark Johnson were here, the actuary, but I guess the question that I would ask, you know, Johnson is the point person here in many ways, and that is that even professionally, he would feel under the gun to do the very best he could in the evaluation process. If it doesn't look good, in many ways, he seems the fall guy. So my question to you concerning that, from PERS standpoint, would you be able to say that going into this evaluation here, that he has everything he needs or has been given everything he needs to perform an accurate valuation?
I believe the answer, Mr. Chairman, is yes. I can assure you he's been given everything he's asked for. I can assure you that the actuarial auditor who's looking over his shoulder has not found anything that we haven't given him that is critical that we have. Now, there are some types of data that that RIMS either doesn't have or don't exist at all, or are controversial. And I don't mean necessarily agency data. I mean, for example, external data developed by consultants about where the stock market will go in the future. All of these types of data are at issue. But I know of no missing data that are critical and material to the valuation. He has not raised those. The actuary auditor has not raised those, and we have not found any either.
Okay. Thank you. It's been said that the current RIM system is not able to give accurate information on current discrete account balances, and that would in some way affect his ability to perform an accurate valuation. Your comments on that?
Well, I don't think that that's likely the case, but the only way to determine that would be to recalculate every single employer and employee account, you know, subjected to a direct audit. What we are doing in the actuarial audit is we are doing, I think, is it 20 test cases? We are taking 20 different test cases and actually doing the calculations. The actuarial auditor is doing the calculations versus M&R. Mm-hmm. To see if they come out at the same end. Whether or not the database has bad data in it, there's no question that it has some bad data in it. The real question is, as you mentioned earlier, are these one of the issues that kind of fall into the, this is irritating, this is nagging, this is not the best administration, but it's not the reason why employer rates are high or the PERS coalition is concerned about the gain loss reserve. Mm-hmm. That issue does not really drive the issues that move hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars around.
One issue that this committee needs to get into, if we are granted another meeting, is the issue surrounding the gain loss reserve. And I think we need to know a whole lot more about that and what the pressures on that are. So we could do that next time around.
Well, I can give you the short answer, and that's great.
Yeah. Okay. To the committee, any further questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
I can move to public testimony, and I do know of one who would like to speak, and that would be Maria Keltner, LGPI. Maria, if you'd come up, please.
Hi, thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Maria Keltner. I represent the League of Oregon Cities and Association of Oregon Counties, and I'm pleased to have this opportunity to speak with you for just a few minutes. I talked with you back in February at your meeting, along with the county commissioner from Josephine County, about the problems with unfunded actuarial liability that came out of the 1997 valuation and the concern that that created cause for many employers. In the testimony that's being handed out, I have written down those numbers for you, which we testified to earlier, that 21 of the 34 counties, 60 of the 184 cities, and 118 of the 261 local entities had unfunded liability, as well as both of the pools had unfunded liability. And we also discussed what those causes were to the best of our ability to determine what the causes were. The benefit increases, anomalies within the system, and that the rates that were set by PERS did not keep the funding for employer accounts on track. So some of them are underfunded, some of them are overfunded, but they weren't kept on track for various reasons. That problem with the unfunded actuarial liability can be eliminated if there is the ability to catch the employer accounts up, and if there is the ability to project benefits, liabilities, and employer rates for the future so that the employer rates keep those employer accounts caught up. And that's one of the core concerns that we have expressed over and over and over again, both to PERS and to various legislators, is that appears to be what is needed in terms of the unfunded actuarial liability. The League of Cities and Association of Counties have been looking at this. We have been asking since the fall of 98, when the valuation information came out, what's causing this problem with rates going up, with volatility of rates. And in order to understand what was causing the problem, we asked repeatedly, how does the system work? We need to know how the system works from A to Z in order to look at it and figure out what's going on, because PERS was not forthcoming with being able to tell us what was causing this problem that we could see and identify. And we've gotten some responses. We've gotten inconsistent information. We've gotten information, then we were told, oh, well, that was wrong, and we got another set of information. We've had a hard time trying to find out how PERS is operating and what's going on. We're very pleased that they are developing written rules, because that's part of what we've been asking for since 98 is, tell us how you're operating the system. How are you doing the math? How are you doing the logic? And we're pleased that they provided some of that today. The flow chart is a piece of how they're operating the system. The rules they're developing, which they've said will take several years to develop, is a piece of developing the system and understanding it. In the meantime, they're telling us that we're supposed to tell them what's wrong with the system, and they won't tell us what they're doing now. It's sort of a catch-22. You identify specifically what the problem is. You identify specifically what the concerns are. We aren't going to tell you what we're doing. You just have to kind of guess. It's a very uncomfortable position to be in, and it's not really helpful to say you identify the problems, but we aren't going to give you any information, and we're not going to tell you how the system's operating. We've been told, trust us. We've been told that the problem was the money match phenomenon and House Bill 3349, but when we asked more questions, we unearthed the issues with the midterm earnings crediting not being equal for employer accounts as it was for employee accounts, which was before the legislature last session, and the board has now adopted a rule to try and equalize that inequity. We uncovered, because we kept asking questions, that the variable account earnings were going to member accounts but not to employer accounts, and the employer accounts therefore couldn't possibly keep up with member growth. But it was because we kept asking questions and figured it out pretty much ourselves, not because there was a lot of help in how does the system operate, so that we could really look at what these anomalies were and make constructive comments and suggestions for what seemed to be out of line or what was causing the problems. So we welcome and encourage those, shall I say, revelations, those sharing of that information with all the stakeholders. Some stakeholders have asked different questions and may have different information, may be able to be more specific than others, or they may have gotten different answers. I don't know. But we're trying to look at the system. We're trying to work constructively with all the stakeholders and the PERS staff and the PERS board and all the parties that are interested, including the legislature. On the back of this testimony that was handed out, several weeks ago I had put together some of the reasons why this complete, clear, transparent documentation of the PERS processes is important and who all it's important to. Some of those people were mentioned by Mr. Voitko in his earlier testimony. But if everybody doesn't know what's going on with PERS, how do we know what we're buying? How do we know what it costs when we're buying PERS benefits? How do we have a chance of looking at what we're paying for and how we're paying for it? How does the consulting actuary know how PERS is managing the accounts and dealing with the issues so that he can project what the benefits are likely to be, project what the liabilities are likely to be, and then determine what employer rate is necessary to keep the account high enough to pay those benefits? It's difficult to understand how that can be done accurately if he doesn't have this clear picture, or how the auditor can audit without a clear picture. And I've listed some others, including the staff needing to know this if they're going to administer the system consistently. They're making ad hoc decisions. They aren't administering the system consistently, and therefore the results are probably not going to come out the way the actuary is projecting in terms of expenses and employer rates.
Maria, could I halt your testimony just for a moment? Jim, could I have you come back up, please?
Mr. Chair, do we need somebody to sit in the middle here?
Yeah, I'm happy to move over. It was more where the mic. How about this?
Might not be a good time, considering the numbers of emergency units that just went by a minute ago. Thank you. Let me stop just for a moment. And, Jim, I don't want to blow this opportunity. We've got a half hour, and I intend to use it here today if we need it, because I got a couple of hundred miles to drive, and I don't want to come back tomorrow and ask these questions. Maria mentioned a moment ago that what you're doing is fine. Flowchart is great, much appreciated. Business rules, too, although they won't be completed for a couple of years. In the meantime, PERS is not, and I think I have the quote accurate, you won't tell them what you're doing. I'm not sure I, Maria, exactly understand what you're saying when you do say that. But Jim, how do you interpret that?
Well, everything that we're doing, we're telling people. And I mean, the example of the flowchart project, this is something that was asked of us, and so we're sharing it with anybody that wants it. And it took an enormous amount of effort to do 17 flows covering 99%+ of the money flows. The second thing is that without any requests from any stakeholders, for that matter, the presentations that I talked to you about before, the analyses of both the gain loss reserve, lump sum issue, and others, were really initiated by the staff. But they were really, we have two. First of all, in order to resolve controversies, we have to decide what's at issue. And I honestly don't care whether people default to the staff to do that or whether stakeholders generate it on their own. It really doesn't matter. To get the system better, somebody has to step up and say, what about this? And so there's actually a little bit of a disadvantage to relying solely on the staff, because we serve as trust beneficiaries, so that we cannot think and act like advocates for employers or for members or organized labor. So there are some types of issues that have to be asked of us. But in the most part, we are generating a list of things to work on our own. So if Ms. Keltner's suggestion is she likes what she sees, well, then I can say with resounding conviction that she'll see more of it,
mm-hmm.
a lot more of it.
In the meantime, before we're through with the completed business rules and so forth, Maria, you again stated that they won't tell you what they are doing. Could you elucidate on that, please?
We've asked in several different methods. One of the ways we asked was, show us from A to Z how the money comes in, how it's processed, the math, the logic, what you do with it in terms of how it's accounted for, how it moves from one account to another, in and out of accounts. We've explained as many different ways as most of us can think of, how are you managing the system? How are you handling the money?
Yep.
How are you determining different things? We've even asked specifically, you know, if somebody retires under money match and they were partly in the variable,
mm-hmm.
you know, how do you do the math? And we've gotten part of the answer, but not enough so we can really tell what's going on.
Jim, do we find that in the flow chart and the business rules, combination of the two, or is that not addressed yet?
Well, I think that there's two fundamental issues at stake here. One is, if there is a PERS problem, how do you define it and resolve it? I think what Ms. Keltner is suggesting is, well, you do the OPUS. You track every dollar, you show every formula, and then you kind of go through it and see, you know, you literally go through it serially and see if you disagree with anything. Quite frankly, I think that's a bad way to approach it, because we know there are some issues that around which there are uncertainties, either because the staff has identified them as things that we're not totally comfortable with, or the board has, or a stakeholder has. And what we're encouraging is, if stakeholders have more ideas about this, let's add them to the pot. Let me give you an example. Mid-year crediting is something that's already finished. It's already done. The solution's in place. And, in fact, the board responded very quickly to the stakeholders' concerns. I think we estimated that that was worth about $83 million. That's not chicken feed. $83 million is important. But let's put it in perspective in terms of understanding causes and things that drive the system. HB 3349 was $1.3 billion. Let's talk about the gain loss reserve issue, which the PERS coalition has before us, as well as the board is interested in that issue. It is conceivable that that could be multiple billion-dollar things. If I have a staff of five or six people that can work on this issue, work on this collection of issues, it is my judgment, and it will be my judgment, that doing an OPUS approach and doing all the things that probably couldn't detect the effect on employer rates if you looked, even if you were doing something wrong, I need to target my resources on things that matter either a great deal to stakeholders for whatever reason, or matter a great deal to the financial dynamics of the system. And therefore, right now, for example, the gain loss reserve is occupying probably 80% of our capacity to do new analysis of money match issues. And why? Because there's a high degree of uncertainty, because we have stakeholders that are concerned about it, because my board is concerned about it, and because it moves major amounts of money. So the OPUS approach, going through every single little calculation, will, in my judgment, has to take a back seat to addressing the issues that could move a couple of billion dollars.
Mm-hmm. Back to the question, and what are you actually saying then to Maria when she brings up those specific issues, those couple of cases where she would like to talk to PERS now and feels that there is no consistent answer, given the scenarios that she mentioned a moment ago?
Well, it all depends on the specifics as to whether it's consistent or not. I mean, will
that, though, be in the flowchart, business rules? What jurisdiction will a situation like she just mentioned fall under?
It depends on what she'd like to talk about. She has several pending questions before us today, as a matter of fact, and we have been unable to shake free all the resources we need to do the work, number one. And number two is some of them require us to write programs for RIMS to extract information that we probably can do, but we're not even sure because RIMS has inherent limitations. So we're working on that issue. But again, that issue, as much as we value this stakeholder concern, this particular narrow stakeholder concern, will always take a back seat to resolving the gain loss reserve issue because it's a blockbuster.
Mm-hmm. All right, thanks. Maria, go ahead if you would. Is there any more?
I think that it's very difficult to respond to pieces of the system or to deal with pieces of the system when nobody seems to have any idea of the overall effects on the system. To deal with this little bit over here and this little bit over here with no concept of the impact on the whole system usually results in unintended consequences. And we've seen some of those in the past. And so saying, ignore the whole system and deal with this little piece here, saying that pooling will take care of all the issues with cost, they probably will have some impact, pooling, on volatility of individual employer rates, but it won't have anything to do with any of these other issues we're talking about in terms of how the system is operated, because that drives rates and costs and consequences, regardless of whether there's one employer account or multiple employer accounts.
Thank you, Jim. I'll let you respond to that, and then I'll let her finish up her testimony unaccompanied. Thank
you. The agency has never maintained that pooling will solve all the cost problems. In fact, that's manifestly not true. We think pooling will have a major effect on the instability or volatility of small employer rates. I don't think there's much question about that. But that is a solution that's targeted at a particularly well-understood and well-defined problem. We'll either succeed, employers will either accept it or not, or whatever, however it'll come about. But we'll accomplish something there, or we won't, but we'll know precisely why. If I could quote another chairman, if you will, Chairman Mao, he said, every journey of a thousand miles starts with a single step. And analysis of a system don't explode full-blown out of anybody's head or anybody's piece of work. You have to go through the pieces, piece by piece, using the same set of logic to try to ferret out unintended consequences or instabilities or volatility that's already in the system. I've done a lot of analysis of big systems and financial systems, and I've never seen a situation in which anybody was capable of throwing out a big, complicated system and explaining it in detail in a heartbeat, especially if there were problems within it. one has to methodically go through it. It's a whole lot less sexy, if you'll pardon the phrase. It's a lot more brutal, but there really isn't any other way. It's just hard work. That's why we do lump sums, mid-year crediting. We roll through every issue, and we say, are we doing this correctly? Is it consistent with the things we've looked at and decided that we are doing correctly? Move on to the next one.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. Maria, go ahead. You'll wrap up your testimony. I appreciate that. Take your time.
And what Mr. Voitko is talking about is basically what we've been asking for. I guess we were fairly surprised to realize that they didn't have written rules and that they're now having to write them. But that was part of the problem, to be asked to comment on something that wasn't even in no place to find it. But we do appreciate the efforts that have been taken. I think there's a lot more work that needs to be done, and there are a lot of concerns that this valuation and subsequent valuations be as accurate as possible.
Okay, very good. Any questions? All right. Thanks to both of you. Appreciate that. Hasina Squires.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I was not going to testify today, but I just have to after hearing Mr. Voitko's remarks. I would just like to start out by one quick side note. In page 8 of this, or 6 of, or 5 of this report, pardon me, there's a section in here that deals, that says, in all three cases, Mercer's suggested lines, and this is talking about the auditor auditing the auditor, the actuary auditing the actuary. There's just a portion in here that I really believe half of the story is left out that says they would tend to make the plan valuation more conservative and raise the overall level of employer rates. That is true, but it doesn't say that Mercer's two suggestions would significantly decrease rapidly, much more rapidly. There was a little chart that was handed out to us at the board meeting in the slides, and the chart was Mercer's recommendations for unfunded actuarial liability over a 30-year period, I believe, and the Milliman and Robertson method that was used in 1997 valuation, the chart just went straight up. And the two suggested changes by Mercer, the chart went straight down in about half of the time, I believe. I wish I had those charts with me. But they're you know, they will make employer rates go up, some of the changes, but they'll significantly reduce unfunded actuarial liability and very quickly. And the path that we're on now is straight up, up and out, for a long period of time. It looked like into eternity for me. So I just wanted to bring that to the committee's attention. And then I'd like to bring up three points, because I do not want to sit up here and complain without specific examples. So I intend to give you three specific examples. The examples that Mr. Voitko referred to as the inability to distill well-defined statements of problems. First, I'm going to give you one example of a past problem that was brought by employers to the board or to the PERS staff. And that past problem was the difference in employers crediting in the variable at the same rate of employees. That's a specific problem. I feel almost offended sitting back there as if his testimony were characterizing employers as sitting back complaining without examples. We don't have anything to tell them. We just say there's something broken. I'm going to give you a past, a current, and a general example of problems. And perhaps we can maybe get some answers for the future problems. So there's a past problem that employers asked to be addressed, and it was addressed. But it is something that was specific, and it was resolved. But it was brought by employers. The second problem that I have is in throughout this document, I think it was two committee hearings ago, Mr. Voitko, actually a year ago, her staff indicated that there would be 50 employers who not only had unfunded actuarial liabilities, but had fewer assets than their employees in their accounts. It was 50 a year ago. Today it's 70 employers. I would like to know how they got in that situation. How did these 70 employers get into the situation? I have yet to hear the difference between the 70 set of employers versus the rest of employers. I don't know the answer to that question. I haven't heard it. I would also like to know, are they going to continue Why are they going to continue? The statement in this document is that they're going to continue to be underfunded, and this problem is only going to get worse for them. Why? What solutions is PERS offering, or options is PERS offering to these employers to get out of this hole? So that's my second problem. And then thirdly, the general problem that I would like to raise is that it's my perception is that PERS has made decisions in the past several times based upon ad hoc policy that they have within their organization, and it had worked for some time, not without having a specific rule to address their policy decision. Then a problem occurs, and an example of that is the lump sum crediting. Then a problem occurs, then PERS meets with stakeholders, we have 10 meetings, we finally get a written rule, and we address the situation. So I really am not pleased to have what I feel employers being characterized as not providing well-defined statements of problems. I've given you a past one, I'm giving you one that's in the future, and sort of a general problem statement.
Thank you. Comments, questions? All right, thanks very much. Anyone else? Okay, I'd like to thank all of you today for your input. Very complicated issue. Thanks for your patience with one another, and I hope that we have an opportunity to have another hearing and really be able to know what we want to do, especially if it requires statute, before we move into the next session. So thanks again, committee. Thank you very much. Appreciate your presence here today. And we're adjourned.